This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Before we begin today's show, we want to let you know that we'll be discussing very disturbing descriptions of violence and racism. Last week, six former white law enforcement officers received sentences of 10 to 40 years for torturing and sexually assaulting two black men, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, in January 2023. The deputies also called the men racial slurs. Last year, an investigation by Mississippi Today and the New York Times exposed a decades-long reign of terror by nearly two dozen deputies in Rankin County, Mississippi, several of them high-ranking investigators who reported directly to the Rankin County Sheriff, Brian Bailey. Last August, Eddie Parker and Michael Jenkins spoke with Democracy Now! After the officers pled guilty.
We want justice. We want justice for everyone that has gone through this with Rankin County or gone through this because of Rankin County. We want justice for the ones that were afraid to speak up. You know, justice for the ones that can't speak up. We want something new and better, you know, and clean to come out of this.
And Michael Jenkins.
Basically the same thing, to make sure that nobody never go through what we went through again. You know, animals don't get treated like this. You know, I ain't never seen no animal get treated like this.
That is Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker speaking with Democracy Now! Last August after the officers pled guilty. Michael Jenkins had a tough time talking because he was shot in the mouth by one of the officers. Today's guest, reporter Brian Howie, writes, residents in impoverished communities in Rankin County have complained that deputies targeted them for years, routinely barging into their homes without warrants and violently shaking them down for information on drug use. Sheriff Bailey, who did not attend the sentencing hearings, has repeatedly denied knowledge of his deputies' actions, but policing experts said the details revealed at the hearings cast further doubt on his claims. Chuck Wexler, executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, said there were so many red flags in the case, it seems unbelievable to think that higher-ups didn't have some knowledge of this. Officers were held accountable for these egregious crimes, but it should not have taken 20 years. Malik Shabazz, the lawyer who represented Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, called the verdict historic. He was on Democracy Now! Last week.
The scene inside of this courtroom in the United States District Court for the sentencing of the Goon Squad was absolutely incredible, and you wouldn't believe it if it was a movie. I mean, to see the big, bad, intimidating, murderous Goon Squad, to see all of them there, to see all of them in court, crying tears out of their eyes and begging the judge, begging Eddie and Michael in this packed room was absolutely incredible. But it was well deserved because so many other families and victims have had to shed those tears and go to jail for a long time behind their crimes and lies. I mean, Amy, it was absolutely incredible. And never have we seen this many police officers sentenced to this kind of time in 1 week. And it was awesome.
That is Malik Shabazz, the lawyer who represented Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker on Democracy Now! Last week. Brian Howie is an award-winning investigative reporter at the Mississippi Center of Investigative Reporting at Mississippi Today. Last year, an investigation by Mississippi Today and the New York Times exposed this decades-long reign of terror. Brian Howie was just awarded a local investigations fellowship with the New York Times, where he will examine local law enforcement agencies throughout Mississippi. Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for the important work you've done on this, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. As we do on our media roundtables, we start the show by highlighting a good piece of reporting. So what caught your attention this week?
I was just reading an Associated Press investigation that published yesterday tracking deaths in police custody after officers used less lethal force. If you haven't had a chance to read this, I highly recommend taking a deep breath first and diving into this story. It's an incredible piece of reporting.
I had a feeling you were going to bring this one up. Yeah, it's a really important one. It's called Why Did More Than 1,000 People Die After Police Subdued Them with Force That Isn't Meant to Kill? And there are several photos of mostly men, but there's one woman there, and it's such a disturbing piece. Mm. Brian, can you, I'm glad you brought this up, because I just wonder, given that you specifically focus on law enforcement, can you talk about how reporting on police has really changed over the years? I mean, since the killing of George Floyd, of course, but even before then, it seems like there's just a lot more reporting now on police violence.
Absolutely. I think this has been a long time coming. I think that journalism has a troubling history of, paying lip service to accountability, specifically government accountability, but falling short when it comes to police reporting. I think Wesley Lowery, another investigative reporter who's covered policing for many years, put it best when he said that, police are some of the most powerful government agents that the average person in America will encounter in their lifetimes. And that level of power requires great scrutiny. I think over the past 20 years or so, the journalism industry has begun to understand that the public really craves a closer look at how this profession interacts with the communities that officers ostensibly protect and serve, and what that actually looks like. And I think we're finally starting to see American journalism take note of these demands and respond in kind.
I wanted to mention a couple more. The Washington Post had a piece recently, another devastating one. A police officer took a teen for a rape kit, then he assaulted her too. And then the AP just yesterday reported on Tennessee Governor Bill Lee signing off on the repeal of police traffic stop reforms made in Memphis after the horrific beating of Tyre Nichols by officers in January 2023. So Memphis passed laws to repeal these police traffic stops, and then the Tennessee governor overruled it.
Yeah, I think, we're seeing yet another example of the sort of cyclical process that we get in policing, and that results in very incremental reforms that take much longer than I think the public is asking for.
Well, let's dive in and talk about this case. And I just have to be honest with you. I followed this from the beginning, and I just can't describe some of the things that happened. It's too difficult. So I would greatly appreciate it if you would. I mean, you can't even think of these things in your darkest hours. Can you first tell us, when were you all just aware? When were you made aware of what these deputies in Rankin County were doing? As you reported last year, this is a decades-long reign of terror. When did you first start hearing about this?
Well, I think it started to hit the national circuit last spring when Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Parker's accusations became public. At the time, I was working in Colorado reporting on the Aurora Police Department, and I remember reading the story about this horrific torture incident. I mean, as you described, officers storming the house of Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Parker, handcuffing them, shocking them repeatedly with tasers, sexually assaulting them with a sex toy, beating them relentlessly, etc. And I just thought it was one of the worst things I'd ever heard of in recent years. And around that time, I actually got asked to come out to Mississippi and do some reporting on policing out there. And Jerry Mitchell, who runs the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting, asked me to take a look at the Rankin County Sheriff's Department. And as he and I, and eventually my colleague Nate Rosenfield, started to take a closer look at the department, people started coming forward saying that they had been beaten up by sheriff's deputies and locked away in a cell until their wounds healed, or that they had had a taser held to their genitals while they were questioned. And we began to realize that, you know, maybe this wasn't just an isolated horrific incident, but more of a pattern at the department.
Did any of these stories get local media coverage before Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker stepped forward to share their stories?
I think there was some local media coverage, but by and large, the actions of these deputies were very well covered up. And I think that there are a couple of factors at play here, right? Number one is the fact that these deputies, when they approached people, when they beat them, when they tortured them, they would warn them, allegedly, that if they told anyone about what happened to them, that the deputies would come back and either kill them or find a way to put them in prison for the rest of their lives. And so many of the people who experienced this conduct were terrified to come forward. And in the few cases where the alleged victims of this department did come forward and did do the right things by fighting their charges, filing complaints, filing lawsuits, oftentimes these things went under the radar. Part of the reason is because local journalism is in a state of crisis right now, and Mississippi is in dire need of more and better investigative reporting. I'm so proud to be a part of the push by Mississippi Today and MCIR to provide that. But, you know, when you have these big gaps in local journalism, cases like this slip under the radar. People don't hear about them until something horrific like this happens. And I honestly do not think that we would be here talking about this today if one of the deputies had not pulled the trigger and shot Mr. Parker in the mouth.
Oh my gosh, this was horrific. Can you explain what happened?
So during this
I'm sorry, yeah, before you do that, let's just go to the beginning of how these deputies even came to this home. And I'm so glad we have you on, because there's so much reporting that there's different stories out there. I've read that they were taking care of a white woman, and a neighbor called and said that black men have a white woman in the home. But it's weird, Brian, because some reports include that and some reports include something completely different. So can you lay out the facts? How did this all start from the beginning?
Sure. So there are conflicting stories as to how exactly the deputies ended up there. But based on the investigation by the Department of Justice, Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Parker were staying at a friend's house in Rankin County. They were helping her take care of the place. She was disabled. She was white. One of them went way back with her. They had gone to school together, I believe. And one of the deputies, the chief investigator at the time, Brett McAlpin, actually lived just down the road from this house. And one of their mutual neighbors called him to complain about alleged suspicious activity happening at this house. Now, we've heard accounts that the neighbor was complaining that there were two black men there associating with a white woman. We've heard accounts that he complained that they were up to no good and suspected that they may be dealing in drugs. The department had been there before for a homicide case in recent years. And so it was sort of on their radar already, but it was the complaint from this neighbor that initiated their visit to the house that night.
Okay, so we don't know for sure if this person called and said, there are two black men with a white woman in this home.
There are strong accounts pointing in that direction. We haven't spoken to this neighbor directly, so I don't want to go beyond that.
Okay, because I just wondered why that wasn't more prominent in a lot of the stories that we've read.
Yeah, I think it's just because there were conflicting accounts on who exactly said what. But okay, what we do know is that the deputies, when they entered this home, used racial slurs against the men. The N-word, they called them monkey, they told them to go back to Jackson, because this was an overarching theme both in this case and in many of the other cases we uncovered, is that the deputies believed that drugs were coming into Rankin County from Jackson.
And we should say, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker are in their early 30s.
Correct.
Okay. So then what happened? Can you just let us know what happened as it was about 2 hours, right?
Yes, it was about 2 hours. The deputies gathered and went to the home. They checked to see if there were surveillance cameras watching the house. They did see one camera, and so they went around to a side door or garage door, I believe, and beat the door open, went inside of the home, and handcuffed Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Parker. They then beat the men with instruments that they found around the house, including a sword, some sort of kitchen implement. Several of the officers used their tasers to shock them repeatedly, as what was described as taser hot potato, where they asked the men which of the tasers hurt worse and continued shocking them until they said which one was worse. One of the deputies then went into a room and found a dildo, a sex toy, mounted it on a BB gun that he found in the house, and then another deputy used it to slap Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Parker across the face. He attempted to force it into their mouths, and at one point put one of the men on his stomach and attempted to sexually assault him with the toy, but stopped when he realized that the man had soiled himself from being tased so many times. Mm. After that, they drizzled kitchen oil and alcohol and I believe syrup over the men's faces, and then forced them to shower together. They also fired guns into the air to scare them into thinking that they were going to shoot them. And after they showered together, Deputy Hunter Elward then took his gun, took a bullet out of the chamber, put the barrel of the gun into Mr. Jenkins' mouth and dry fired the gun to scare him into thinking he was going to execute him. He then cocked the gun again, and this time chambered a bullet, put the gun back into Mr. Jenkins' mouth, and pulled the trigger and shot him in the face, lacerating his tongue, shattering his jaw, and shredding his neck. Then Mr. Jenkins was left to lie on the floor bleeding as the deputies began to concoct a cover-up story. They decided on a narrative in which Mr. Jenkins pulled a BB gun on Mr. Elward, and Mr. Elward thought it was a gun and decided to shoot him in self-defense. They disposed of evidence. They destroyed the CCTV footage by throwing the hard drive that contained the footage into a local river. They threw shell casings and the men's soiled clothes into the woods. And one of the deputies planted methamphetamine that he had on him on both of the men to justify the raid in the first place.
Horrific description, Brian, but thank you. We need to know that this is happening, and you have to wonder how many other people had to endure this torture and will never know about it.
We are certainly wondering that even to this day. I mean, you know, we found 17 additional incidents involving 22 victims who claim that deputies tortured them during arrests. And we're not talking about just these six officers who were involved in this one incident. We identified 20 deputies who were present or somehow involved in these incidents. So there are five deputies involved in this original incident. That leaves another 15 who have not faced any criminal charges.
We played a clip from Michael Jenkins from last year. He had a hard time talking because he was shot in the mouth. I just want to play a clip just to let people know how the families are treated during something like this. This is Michael Jenkins' mother, Mary Jenkins, who spoke outside of the federal courthouse in Jackson, Mississippi last week.
When I first found out that my son was shot and that he was shot in the mouth, I was almost certain that he was dead. I called Rankin County, and at first they wouldn't let me speak with anyone. They said they were in a meeting. And when I finally spoke with someone, I asked him if my son was alive. And he said, as far as I know. I said, well, when can I see him? He said, when we let you see him. This is a crying mother on the phone trying to inquire about her son. He said, Michael is our property. That's what that deputy told me on the phone. My son shot in the mouth, and he's telling me that Michael is their property.
That is Michael Jenkins' mother, Mary Jenkins, speaking outside the federal courthouse in Jackson, Mississippi last week. It really just speaks to how the system operates, Brian, and how people are treated by these law enforcement officials. Given all of that, what has your experience been like reporting on all of this and trying to get higher ups to answer questions about how this could have happened for so long and why so few people have been held accountable?
Yeah, I'd say that one of the great challenges of this reporting is actually getting people in higher up positions at the department and in oversight positions at state or local levels to talk. Really, we hit a lot of brick walls during that portion of the reporting, and our reporting largely relied on using public records requests, which compelled the department to release records related to the incidents we were looking into, and extensive reporting with members of the public who had claimed that they were mistreated by the department. We had to base most of our reporting on that because so few people in positions of power agreed to talk to us about this.
Where can you tell us before we let you go? I just think it's so important to focus on the people who were tortured and assaulted, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker. Capital B News had a piece with a number of quotes from both of them. And I mean, it's devastating. Eddie Parker said, "I don't know if I'll ever be able to sleep again at night. I am in constant fear someone will break into my home and terrorize me again. I fear I will be attacked again or even killed by police in Rankin." He went on to say, "I'm just hoping that everything comes out right because everything needs to be done. What was done cannot be erased, cannot be taken back. I relive this every day." Can you just tell us, you can't even imagine, how do you move on from something like this? I mean, what strikes you about what you've heard from Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker and what they had to endure by reliving this in the courtroom last week?
You could tell in court. We were there with them every day, speaking to them after every hearing, and you could tell that this was weighing on them so heavily. They had to give a victim impact statement for each sentencing. And Mr. Jenkins, in his statements, repeatedly said that his entire life had been turned upside down. He was a musician, a singer in the church choir. He played drums. He couldn't do either of those anymore because his injuries prevented him from singing anymore, and his vision had been affected by his injuries as well, and it kept him from playing drums anymore. And so this had not just traumatized him deeply, but robbed him of several of his passions in life. And the same goes for Mr. Parker, and the same goes for many of the people that we spoke to who have not gotten any justice for what happened to them. They are still waking up in the middle of the night. They're still terrified whenever they see a police officer. Some of them go to great lengths to avoid Rankin County altogether because they are terrified of having another encounter with the sheriff's department there. And so what we've seen both in Mr. Parker and Mr. Jenkins' cases and in the many other victims who've come forward is that this was a reign of terror. They used terror to control people across this county. And it's going to take years for the county to heal from this, I think.
Before we let you go, have there been major changes in the police department? Do you think other higher-ups will be held accountable? And how are officials in Mississippi responding to these horrific crimes?
It's hard to say whether or not there are other officials will be held accountable. We do know that the Department of Justice's investigation is not through yet. They are continuing with their investigation of the Rankin County Sheriff's Department. And so we'll just have to wait and see what comes forward from there. We do know that a slew of police accountability bills have been introduced at the Mississippi State Legislature, at least a couple of them inspired by the actions of the Rankin County Sheriff's Department and the findings of my colleagues Jerry Mitchell and Alyssa Daly with the New York Times and Mississippi Today, looking at other sheriff's departments and allegations of sexual assault by sheriffs in other counties. And so this has definitely spurred action. I think it's a little early to say how many teeth these bills will have, how much effect it will have on law enforcement as a whole, but we'll be keeping an eye on that.
Wow. Well, Brian, huge thanks for your important work on this. Brian Howie is an award-winning investigative reporter at the Mississippi Center of Investigative Reporting at Mississippi Today. Last year, an investigation by Mississippi Today and the New York Times exposed a decades-long reign of terror by nearly two dozen Rankin County deputies, several of them high-ranking investigators. Brian was just awarded a local investigations fellowship at the New York Times, where he will examine local law enforcement agencies throughout Mississippi. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And you can learn more about this case and learn more about Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about gang violence and the dire humanitarian crisis happening in Haiti. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.